down there and working away. And being this lowly med student, he's like four layers out up in the bleacher seats. And he's out there and he can't really see anything. And suddenly, at what point, the people in front of him part. And out comes the chief surgeon and says, "Oh, you're the new med student. First day, that's great. Surgery, you're going to love it. So glad you're here, all of that. You want to do something? You want to? Yeah, great. Okay, good attitudes. And come on in here. Here's what I'm going to do. Take this hemostat. And I need you to clamp onto something." So he takes my friend's arm and pulls it way over into the surgical area. My friend can't even see, but the surgeon clamps the hemostat onto something. My friend's arm is extended there. The crowd comes pouring back. The surgeon says, "Okay, hold on there because it's really important." And they go back to surgery and hours go by and like he can't even see what's happening there. All he can see is every now and then, you know, some bloody towels or kidneys go flying over people's shoulders. Hours more go by, and eventually my friend's reaching this point where he's starting to get a little bit woozy from standing in that exact same position, his arm stuck forward. He's just about to keel over when suddenly, right there an inch in front of his face, is the surgeon saying, "Don't move a muscle, you're going to screw up everything." So he manages to hold on for a last couple of hours there. They finish the surgery, the crowds part, and he discovers the hemostat has been clamped onto some towel up there. Major traditional hazing joke that had been played on him. Number one, teaching you in a case like this, do not let go. You're going to screw up everything. This is not a circumstance where you want to have more of a sense of control than you actually do. Number two, he did not go into surgery for a profession. So this whole possibility that, in fact, you can have too much of a sense of control. We've already seen that in a very pernicious way back in the lecture about cancer, that study, women who had just gotten the metastatic breast cancer diagnosis. So what do you think is the cause of your cancer? And as we saw, the most common answer being stress, and we saw the really poisonous, damaging way in which that lack of information, that lack of validity can come back to haunt you is if the conclusion you make there then is, "Oh, it's my fault, thus that I had the cancer. I could have prevented it if it's something that's due to stress." That's another realm where inflating, exaggerating a sense of control isn't a great thing. Now, these dangers of, you know, an overly inflated sense of control can even manifest itself in a personality style, one where people consistently have more of a belief that they have control than is actually the case. And this is a style called John Henryism, first described by Sherman James, Duke University. And John Henryism is based on the folk legend of John Henry, which I don't remember in too much detail, but John Henry, who worked the rails with his big old hammer, and they brought in some machine that was supposed to do it better than any human, and he went head-to-head competing with the machine, and impossibly he defeated the machine that could not be defeated, and hammering away, and then keels over dead. This describes what John Henryism is about. This enormously energetic optimism, and one that is just suffused with a belief that there is control in everything. People with a John Henryism type profile will say things like, "Well, you know, when things don't go right, you just pick yourself up and work even harder." Or things like, "Once I make my mind up to try to accomplish something, nothing can stop me." What's wrong with that? That's wonderful. That's a sense of efficacy. That's an internal locus of control. That's a great thing. Why is this a personality disorder, which is in fact linked to an increased risk of high blood pressure, hypertension? Because this is a personality style that's found among some working class African Americans. And the argument there being from James is, if in a setting like this, where an awful lot of one's problems in life, you can't just pick yourself up and dust yourself and you can overcome anything. And gosh, if people just talk to each other, everybody could get along. Face racism, face things of that sort. And there's no degree of, you know, if you just set your mind to it, you're going to be able to accomplish anything. And what do you see as the correlate of that? As I mentioned, an increased risk of hypertension. You don't see that in middle-class African Americans. You don't see that in working-class white Americans. It's a marker of people who feel like they have more control in a setting where they actually don't. And this whole business about this belief that enough control and you're on top of everything, this doesn't necessarily work, as we've seen. And it reminds me of this old parable, what's the difference between heaven and hell, and what, as it goes, heaven, you spend all of eternity studying the holy books, and whereas in hell, you spend all of eternity studying the holy books. Ah, it's how you interpret it. Each of us has the potential to turn our hells into heaven. It's appraisal, it's evaluative. It's not appraisal, it's not evaluative, it's not context dependent when you're dealing with someone who's a refugee, when you're dealing with someone with terminal cancer, when you're dealing with someone homeless. It's not the place there to sit down and say, ooh, did you know how much psychological factors have to do with health and the stress response? You just have to feel like you have more control in life. No, you don't do that, because that barrels you into the realm we've already considered of inflating a sense of control, especially in people undergoing adverse circumstances, and all you're doing is blaming the victim and setting somebody up to think, ooh, it could have been so much better, and it's my fault that it didn't happen because I had control. So we see here the wonderful advantages, the wonderful possibilities by increasing a sense of control. Not in all settings, cautionary note. Moving on to the next sort of intervention. What else can you do? Social support. That one is obvious from all those studies we've heard about by now, starting with rats grooming each other to holding the hand of someone you like and love and trust, and you don't have as much of a cardiovascular response to a scary procedure. Social support. And thus, we're going to have a similar theme here, which is that's not a blanket recommendation. There's all sorts of realms in which not only doesn't it do you much good, it can make things worse. One example. A number of years ago, a very humanely motivated rule came down the pike concerning laboratory primates, when in a lot of experimental settings, they're singly housed. In other words, social primates living alone in a cage. And the ruling that came down was, even if these are animals that have to be singly housed because of the nature of the experiment, once a week you need to have to let them be in a large social group in an open space to get some social contact, social support. And anyone who was a primatologist knew this was going to be a disaster, because you put a whole bunch of monkeys together in a place where they don't know each other, and they're going to spend the first year or so punching it out with enormous amounts of social conflict until they figure out the social hierarchy. In social groups of primates, it often takes up to a year. And what you do here is, if once a week you allow these monkeys to have some social support in this group, all they're going to do is stress each other like mad, because every single week they've got to start this process all over again of who's the tough guy. And once this actually stabilizes into a hierarchy, if it ever happens, the ones who wind up at the bottom of the hierarchy are going to do terrible as well. This being a realm where socialization is not necessarily stress-reducing. Another example in a realm of another type of primate, a psychoneuroimmunological question that's been asked in research, which is, well, what are the effects of marriage on the immune system? And in studies of men, the answer comes back absolutely clear, which is getting married improves your immune system. That's great. Maybe even back to that sort of Harvard study, stable long-term marriage. Getting married improves immune function in men during the year after they've married. Women. Oh, no, it doesn't work that way in women. Women are so picky. Women aren't just satisfied with marriage. It's got to be a good marriage. Ah, these guys, like, as long as there's somebody who feeds a meatloaf every now and then, they suddenly make a whole lot more white blood cells. Here we see the possibilities. Marriage is not necessarily a panacea if it does not supply the social support that one may actually be needing. And what we see here is that there are a few things that are as helpful as true intimate social support, and there are as few things that are undoing as when that ostensive social intimacy turns out to be misplaced. Now, within this realm of social support and social support is stress reducing, one version of social support that, in my opinion, is way underemphasized in this literature is stress reduction, stress management with sociality, making a point of going about helping someone else. And there's an interesting cross-cultural pattern with that. In both American and East Asian populations, and this has been well studied, social interactions help to reduce stress. In the United States, what does that typically take the form of? It's good to have somebody else there who you feel close to, so you can bitch and moan to them about how awful things are. Whereas typically in East Asian populations, what you see is when things are stressed, it's good to have somebody else around so you could reflexively, just obsessively ask them, how are things going? A big difference between an individualistic and a communal sort of society. Social support works only under some circumstances, and don't mistake social support for being only a realm in which you get to lean on somebody else. Next potential area of sort of good outcomes, religiosity. As you might guess, this is one incredibly controversial field, but built around a fairly undeniable fact, which is religiosity, religious belief, is associated with a longer lifespan and a lot of healthier outcomes. Super controversial nonetheless. Part of it's arguments about, well, these effects are there. How big of effects are they? Part of it is that there's this enormous complexity that religiosity doesn't come in just one flavor. There's different kinds of religious belief. A Pentecostalist is a whole lot different from a Unitarian. There's a difference between religiosity and spirituality. It's a very complex sort of field to try to challenge. And then there's the one enormous confound in there, the same one that came up with the meditation literature, which is the self-selection bias, which is, it's not just random who winds up being religious. Maybe people who already have a certain bent that would predispose towards more health are more religious. And it's particularly hard to do this like a decent scientific study. You can't take your subjects, divide them in half, and say, okay, you guys go believe there is a benevolent God who loves you, and you guys don't believe anything, and let's meet in a year and see how everybody's blood pressure is. Very, very hard to do these studies. More reasons why they're very hard. When you look at religious individuals, in general, you are often at a higher than expected rate. Also looking at individuals who do not drink to excess, who have all sorts of lifestyle factors that work better for them. Is it due to the religiosity or is it due to the lifestyle issues? You got to control for that. Oh, the next problem. Typically, people who are highly religious, what they get amid their religiosity, they also get a community of social support. Okay, is it the religious belief or is it all the great sociality stuff we've heard of? You got to control for that as well. So you go through all of that, and these are enormously difficult studies to go through. And the people in the field, the best people who really support the notion that there are beneficial health effects of religiosity, the people who really are skeptical about it, one thing they agree on is most of the studies are uninterpretable exactly because of these confounds. But when you cut through it, what do you see in the literature? Religiosity tends to increase protection against cardiovascular disease. It tends to help against depression. It does increase life expectancy. All of those are quite clear. What the literature is also quite clear about is it has no impact on cancer incidence or progression. No surprise, we had an entire lecture about that one. In general, religiosity is more protective at preventing the emergence of disease than curing it in the aftermath. And what's also clear is there are hierarchies of types of belief. And in terms of tapping into psychological issues of stress, so you can have somebody at a certain level who believes there is a God, and that's all they know, and that comes with a certain amount of protective power, attribution. Then there's a next step where you believe there is a God who listens to you. Control, predictability. Then there's the level of the God you believe in who listens to you and listens preferentially to you and people who dress like you or eat like you or pray like you, even a higher level of a sense of control. A very tough literature to tackle. Nonetheless, what the critics and the zealots agree on is they're not huge effects, but there definitely is some protection. What they also agree on is what this literature should never, ever, ever wind up doing is suggesting that part of clinical medical therapeutics should be the doc sitting you down and saying, hey, did you know religion is good for your health? Maybe it's time to start becoming religious. So a very, very messy, controversial field in that regard. Okay, so what else? What else can be going on here? What other possibilities can we intervene with? Cognitive flexibility. This one is extremely important. And this is the whole notion that part of what stress responsiveness, part of what stress success is recognizing when your strategy isn't working and it's time to do something different. And this is very nicely summarized in sort of this view as to stress management over the course of life history. When you were young, what stress management is about is trying to make the stressor go away. As you get older, what effective stress management is about is learning to adapt to the inevitable. And this is a very important difference. And this was wonderfully summarized in a quote that I once heard in a Quaker meeting, which was as follows. In the face of strong winds, let me be a blade of grass. In the face of strong walls, let me be a gale of wind. What is this saying? It's saying some of the time what stress management is about is tackling whatever the problem is, whatever the impediment is, and tearing down walls of constraint and triumphing over your limits. And some of the time what stress management is about is here's the blasting wind, and the thing to be under this circumstance is a blade of grass, and get bent down and the winds will pass and they're all over with, and you come backing, bouncing back up. So some of the time, what things are about with stress management and successful stress management is cognitive flexibility. You know what? The solution to this problem that's not getting solved is to do the thing I normally do, but do it 17 times as much and faster and more intensely, and that's going to solve things. An awful big challenge is when realizing, you know what? Got to try something completely different, or you know what? This isn't going to go away. I need to start accepting it. Now, what this all brings up amid this complex set of advice here that, yes, control is good, a sense of control is great, unless it's a disastrous stressor, unless it's something that's uncontrollable, predictive information is good, but only within certain parameters. Inevitably, what this brings us to here is that famed Reinhold Niebuhr quote, the Serenity Prayer that we're all familiar with, this notion of being able to accept the things you cannot change, having the courage to change the things that are changeable, and, of course, having the wisdom to tell the difference between the two. And this is a very good place to begin to wind up here. Stress is not everywhere. Stress is not universal. Stress does not explain all our diseases, but when it does, there are some rules. Control, but not trying to control the uncontrollable. Where there is control, the journey begins with one step. You need little pieces of taking on these massive challenges. Predictive information is helpful, but only for things where it actually is useful to know about it. Outlets should be benign. You should not give ulcers in order to avoid getting one. You need to have the outlets on a regular basis. Sociality can be wonderful, except there's nothing that does us in more when it turns out that something we thought that counted as intimacy turned out to be grossly misplaced. Yes, all of these rules. And all of these rules, again, in the context that every disease out there is not stress-related. Getting things into perspective is not going to help cure your cancer or your homelessness. The world of what these last 24 lectures were about was predominantly the world of middle-class, harried, neurotic problems, the ones that we are all consumed with. And within that realm, it has much to do with stress. And on a certain level, that brings us absolutely back to where we started. Very few of us are getting stressed because we are running away from saber-toothed tigers. Instead, we have this bizarre, cognitively complex, primate, westernized lifestyle luxury of just wallowing in psychogenic stressors. And that's really the final point here. Insofar as we are smart enough to make these things up and foolish enough to then fall for them, all of us have the potential to instead keep them in perspective. So good luck with your stressors.
We hope you have enjoyed these lectures from our Great Courses series. Our courses are now available to order online. Visit our website at www.teach12.com or call our customer care representatives at 1-800-TEACH-12. That's 1-800-TEACH-12. Thank you very much.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.